Hour or two, sometimes whole nights he had spent in the dark, the pain of his stripes receding to make way for fear. The shed itself had no place in the picture, no shape or form, only the darkness within it, and the plenitude of light he had stepped out into the morning of his escape. That dawn he had found a short bar inside and used it to wrench the door off its hinges. He had never forgotten this violent conquest of the dark, the feel of the metal, the joy and fear of the splintering wood, the revelation of light that cold morning, with sheep coughing in the field above and the distant sound of a dog barking. Within half an hour he had been on the upland road, and begging lifts to Bristol. He had run away often since then, but all flight had been attended by the radiance of that dawn. He was thinking of it now, when he heard steps on the stairs coming down. Chapter 13. Billy Blair woke from stupor to find himself lying in fetid darkness, in the hold of some old flat-bottomed hulk, like a barge. She was moored in deep water. He could feel how she moved in her chains. His face was stiff with dried blood, and his right eye gave him pain. Someone, not far away, was whimpering tearfully.
"What's that snuffling?" he said.
Faint light came through the ill-fitting planks of the deck above, and he heard sounds of movement there.
"Got any grog up there, shipmen?" he called up. "I am parched."
Somebody brought a face down close to the deck boards and spoke through.
"You can have water." "Water's no bloody use, man. My throat is on fire."
He paused, casting round for further arguments.
"The bastards have cooped us up down here," he said with pathos.
After a moment or two longer, the hatch was raised, and he saw the tousled head of a man looking down at him.
"You'll keep your napper stowed below there, and don't try no tricks. I've been set over you till we gets aboard, and I will do it. I ain't risking the bilboes for you, so you better not think of trying to cut loose."
"Oh, there's a friendly soul," Billy said. "All I'm asking from yen Christian to another is, have you got any grog?"
There was a short silence, and then, to his delight, Billy saw a bottle swinging down to him, tied with a cord round the neck.
"God bless you," he said, grasping at it. "I will overlook them former threats. What's your name?"
"Kavanagh," the man said. "The other one here with me is Hughes."
"I am Billy Blair."
He took a drink from the bottle, felt the spirit take its fiery course down his throat.
"Ah, by God," he sighed, "that's better."
The hatch was lowered, leaving him once again in darkness. A melancholy voice spoke from somewhere near him.
"Give us a drop, Billy, for the love of God."
"What's that?"
"It's me, Michael Sullivan."
"Sullivan! How the pox did you get here?"
"Same way as you. They knocked me senses out of me and brung me over and threw me down in this floating stinkhole."
The voice paused a moment, then said with deepened sadness,
"And me giving them no cause for offence at all."
"Were you whimpering and crying just now?"
"No, I was not. I was lying quiet here, thinking of me troubles."
"Well," Billy said, "it serves you right. I am passing the bottle to you because it is a charity, but I don't know that I would choose to drink with you in other circumstances, now that I see what you have come down to, playing the fiddle in a whorehouse and helping to sell poor sailor lads."
He saw a dark form raise itself in the dimness of the hold, made out the pallor of the face. He extended the bottle, felt it taken from him, heard Sullivan take a long swallow.
"That is not work to be proud of, Michael," he said, "and just gun easy with that bottle, will you? Here, let's have it back." "I was doing fine till you came on the scene," Sullivan said in a stronger voice. "No, it's my bloody fault, is it?"
"You had to come into that place, didn't you? And just the time when I was in it. Sure, the divil directed your steps, and that wasn't the only place I played in, and they wasn't all whorehouses and snuffle dens. If a man finds himself in bad company, he keeps mum. That is the first rule, and I broke it like an eejit. I could get a bite to eat and a dram and a place to lay me head, and I could play me fiddle. Then you come in, full of piss and wind. And I remember you straight off, because you always was full of piss and wind. You haven't changed one iota, and I does me best to warn you, but you're too drunk to understand anything at all. Like an eejit, I get in the way of the fighting and get knocked off me feet and end up here."
"Well," Billy said, after a pause for reflection, "I see how it was. You play the part of a friend to me, and Billy Blair does not forget his friends. Here, I forgive you. Have another pull at the bottle.
You forgive me? Holy Mary, that's rich.
There is someone else here as athirst,
a quiet voice said from the darkness forward of them. Raising himself on one elbow, Billy peered through the dark, made out a man sitting upright with the boat narrowed at the bows.
What's that?
The name is Deacon. I've been pressed here, same as you.
Pass him the bottle,
Billy said in a tone of resignation.
Was that you snuffling just now?
No, there's another fellow here alongside of me.
As if this were a signal, the whimpering began again. Deacon hesitated a moment, then reached out and touched the shoulder of the man lying near him, pressed against the boat's side.
Hold your noise, he said. What's your name?
Donald Kelly,
the voice came, choked with mucus and tears.
I don't want to stay here.
Pechabers! Sullivan said in a tone of affected surprise. You up there, he called out. There's a man here says he doesn't want to stay. I think he should see the captain.
A different voice answered this time, harsher, more violent than the first.
Damn you, stir your gab. There's no more rum. You get a bucket of bilge water if you don't keep quiet.
Deacon kept his hand on the man's shoulder a few moments longer. The choked voice had touched something in him. He had heard men cry for pain before, and he had stood at the guns, on decks strewn with bodies and running with blood, and wept with exhaustion, but he had never heard a grown man whimper with misery like this. Now, in his despair, it was as if he heard his own tears of the past, heard his own voice in the dark nights of long ago, and found a comforter.
"Keep your spirits up, Daniel," he said. "Be a man. There is nothing to do but wait for the morning."
"Aye," Billy said. "A man has to look on the bright side. I got a few drams and a plate of meat pies before that screw took off with me purse. I wish I could have fucked her and all,"
he added wistfully.
"You will lose more than that again," Sullivan said. "Whatever they have given the landlord for us comes out of our wages, maybe 2 guineas apiece."
"God will find that fat buggeranto of a landlord, and in case not, I will find him out when I get back, and I will slit him up the nose. You lads, let's have the bottle back this end."
"Don't you be mentioning God to me. I stopped believing in him years ago, but now I am going to give him up for good. He has shipped me on a slaver, only for trying to stand up for a shipmate."
"Aye, that's right," gloom descended on Billy. "Took for the Africa trade," he said bitterly. "And look at that, there's nowt left of the bottle. Them fellas doing there have sopped it all up."
After a long silence, during which Billy thought Sullivan had fallen asleep, the mournful voice came out of the darkness.
"I hope me fiddle is all right. If they have broke it, I will have the law of them, sure as me name's Michael Sullivan."
"Law of them, you daft bumbo. They have threw you down here. They're going to send you chasing quashies up and down all the pox-ridden rivers of the Guinea coast, and you talk about getting the law on them for the sake of your bloody fiddle."
"I see well that you know nothing at all about the law," Sullivan said. "Me fiddle is property. It comes under a different heading."
Sitting above in the ramshackle shelter they had built aft of the hatchway, with Kavanagh asleep beside him, Hughes heard the voices below and the silence that surrounded the voices, and both sound and silence were of the same quality to him and had the same degree of meaning. The sky was clearing now, after the rain, and the wind was veering sou'west and freshening. He could hear the strengthening slap of the wash against the buoy to which the hulk was moored. While the wind stayed in that quarter, they would not clear the river. He sat hunched against the chill, his cloak over his shoulders. He did not like the proximity of Kavanagh, breathing heavily beside him, but there was no other shelter on the hulk. Human beings too close constricted him to the point of violence sometimes. On board ship he never slept below, except in the worst of weathers. Neither did he like the job of guarding pressed men. It made for bad blood at sea, but he had been detailed for it and had no intention of getting a flogging for their sake, so he kept awake. Men determined enough might start the hatch or the rotten planking of her sides and try to swim for it. He was impatient for the sea again. At 43, Hughes was a stranger on land. Brief, violent debauches at her dirty edges was all in 25 years he had known of her. When there was nothing left to spend, there was no reason for being ashore. Penniless, light-headed with drink and venery, Hughes signed for the first ship he could get, so long as she was an ocean-going vessel. That this one was a slave ship made little difference. He had been on slave ships before. He looked towards her now, where she lay out in the road. He could make out her deck lamps, their lights softened and diffused by the vaporous air surrounding her. She was enveloped in the mist of her own breath. She was a new-built ship, and her timbers were breathing. Hughes knew this well enough. New timber would always steam on a cool night. But there are different sorts of knowledge, and he had no doubt either that the Liverpool merchant was panting for the open sea. Chapter 14. Late on the following day, the wind changed direction slightly, veering between west and south. Thurzo, checking stores with his gunner, a lanky man named Johnson, between decks in the after part of the ship, felt the change at once in the way she settled between wind and tide. He felt it in the balance of his body, as one might feel a change in the rhythm of music, though nothing showed in his face or changed in his voice.
"Wind coming around ahead of us, Captain,"
the gunner ventured, and received the full glare of the small eyes.
"When I want your opinion of the weather, or anything else, I'll ask for it." "Aye, aye, sir."
Later, in the forecastle, Johnson was to relate, with suitable embellishments, this brief exchange, laying the first strand in the tissue of gossip, bravado, calumny, and indirect abuse, which is spun hour by hour and breath by breath among the crew of a ship, and is that ship's unwritten journal, voluminous, untrustworthy, dissolving like a dream when the ship reaches port and the crew is disbanded.
"Turned on me like a tiger, he did, only because I spoke first. I tell you, he is going to be a tartar, this one. It wasn't just letting me know who was skipper, he was savage-like, as if he would have had me seized up straight away for a good dozen."
Shortly after midnight, they cast off from the pierhead. Running under her topsails against the flood, obedient to the cables that towed her, the Liverpool merchant headed slowly towards the estuary. On the ebb, she moored at Black Rock and waited for a change in the wind, in company with two small brigs and a Danish schooner bound for Dublin. They were obliged to stay here for the 2 days following. The pilot boat came in from Liverpool with supplies of powder and bread and two sides of beef. Simmons saw to the hoisting in of these, with Thurso's eye upon him. The ship was fully loaded now, and there was need for care in the stowage if she was to handle properly in the seas she would meet. There was work enough, apart from this, to keep the crew busy. Barton, his ear always alert for the hoarse voice from the quarter-deck, saw to the rigging of the jib-boom, and had the sails fixed on the longboat. Men were set plaiting rope yarns for cordage, and making deck swabs out of old rope. Callie could not master this so soon, and had to begin with something simpler. As a first step towards the delights he had been promised, he found himself, in company with a ragged, shivering runaway of 14 named Charlie, untwisting old ropes to make oakum for caulking seams and stopping leaks. Libby, the big one-eyed Londoner, veteran of several slaving trips, was given a special task, one he was well qualified for, having once been boatswain's mate on a 74-gun frigate. He was set down on the main deck, in full view of all, to fashion a cat-o'-nine-tails. This was a long-standing practice of Thurzo's, it being the captain's fixed belief that it did the men good to see, as they went about their tasks, the plaiting of the stem, the drawing out one by one of the 9 log-line branches of the whip, the ritual tying of the 4 knots in each. It convinced them from the start of the seriousness of his intentions. Paris, pleased to find himself so far clear in mind and untroubled in stomach, passed the time in reading, writing the first pages of the journal he had resolved to keep, and walking about on deck, where he was able to follow Libby's progress with the fearsome whip more closely than he liked. He had discovered that the small, malodorous room below the waterline, which had been allotted as sick bay, was taken up with rope and tackle and spare sailcloth. Twice he had attempted to speak to Thurzo about this, but the captain had bitten him off short. Nonetheless, he was determined to take the matter up again at the first favourable opportunity. On the third day, at a few minutes after 4 o'clock in the morning, Simmons, whose watch it was, felt the wind turn fair against his face. As instructed, he roused Thurzo immediately. The captain waited for the top of the high water, then gave orders to weigh anchor. Paris woke to the wailing cries of Haines, the boatswain, He dressed quickly and came up in the first light, to a scene of uproar and apparent confusion, shouted orders he could not make out, bewildering movements about the deck. Thurzo stood above, on the quarter-deck, the only motionless element in this violent pandemonium. Then Paris began to see the division of tasks among the crew as they worked to spread and loose the great square mainsails. He heard the strange, drawn-out lamentation of men heaving at the windlass, and in a few minutes knew that the ship was under way, knew it from the noise of the water thrown from her bows, from the way she leaned over in the damp dawn breeze and rolled with the heavy ground-swell. And so, in the course of that morning, the Liverpool Merchant was turned loose into the Irish Sea. With her mainsails set and a fair wind from the southeast, released from tethering rope and umbilical cable, she was, for the first time in her life, unfettered, free, save for her own groaning tensions between wind and current. Part 3, Chapter 15. Erasmus Kemp stood by the lakeside. The scene he looked forward to and dreaded was almost upon him. Recently, between his public and private performances as Ferdinand, a yawning gap had developed. He had his lines by heart and could recite them perfectly when alone, but once in her presence his tongue stumbled, his throat dried. It was not timidity. He was not by nature timid, and would have welcomed the opportunity to speak his love in his own voice. What disconcerted him so terribly was having to pretend, as the price of being with her, that both of them were other people. Nevertheless, he went on trying. Practicing before the mirror in his bedroom, he had achieved fluid and graceful motions of the hands and body, and even dazzled smiles, as at blinding beauty. But when it came to the rehearsals, he moved like an automaton about the shores of the lake. He nursed the hope, and into it went all the passionate tenacity of his nature, that by endurance the gap would be closed, and the accomplishments of his solitude win the day. Of this there was small sign, as yet. Meanwhile, though he was too locked in his travail fully to notice it, he was having a subtly demoralizing effect on the others. Miranda's performance had lost sparkle, partly through the infection of his awkwardness, partly out of awe at the intensity of his regard, and this central uneasiness between the lovers was exacerbating the strains and divisions already existing among the cast. Prospero's headlong, domineering style was continuing to cause resentment. Miss Edwards sang beautifully, but was felt to be too sardonic for Ariel, especially when addressing Prospero, whom she disliked. And doubts concerning the curate's interpretation of Caliban were felt by just about everyone. Now they were nearing the end of Act Three. Hippolyto, who was played by a friend of Charles, had reached the final lines of the soliloquy in which he declares his intention of having as many women as he can, now that he has discovered that the creatures exist. He was doing rather well in the part, combining a certain foppishness of style with the erotic innocence of one who, kept in solitary confinement by Prospero on the Enchanted Isle, had never till now seen a specimen of womankind. Erasmus, who could not remember envying anyone anything before, found himself envying Hippolyto's assurance as he moved across to exit with the final words of the soliloquy. I now perceive that Prospero was cunning, for when he frightened me from womankind, those precious beings he for himself designed. Erasmus knew that he must go directly, before the entry of Prospero and Miranda, and conceal himself in his cell. But he hesitated some moments longer, looking towards the parkland on the other side of the lake, at the yellow of the new oak leaves, the stiff white cones of flower on the chestnuts, more vivid still for the lustreless surface of the leaves. Beyond was the gate in the wall, the ground sloping upward, a hawk wheeling high above.
"Time you were creeping, Kemp."
One of the several things about Bulstrode that others found irksome was his habit of trying to direct the play and the way he sought to disguise this under a cloak of facetiousness.
"Into your den,"
he added now, with a false smile. Erasmus gave him a glance of disdainful surprise before moving forward and ducking into the low structure of canvas and lath they had put up some yards back from the water. Sitting a little way inside it, he was invisible to Prospero and Miranda, who had now appeared by the lakeside. He heard Prospero utter the opening words of his speech with the gusty grandiloquence the tutor brought to the role.
"Your suit has pitied and has prevailed. Within this cave he lies, and you may see him."
Erasmus waited for this to come to an end, then counted to 12, took a breath, and began, "To be a prisoner where I dearly love is but a double tie." The first lines did not tax him much, as they were addressed to himself, and uttered within the solitude of his cave. He even achieved a certain declamatory force in their delivery. They were the truest of all his lines, the most truly expressive of his condition. Ferdinand's captivity exactly coincided at this point with his own. He was a prisoner of the play itself. These rehearsals, so chafing to the natural haughtiness of his spirit, his subjection to the condescension of Parker and Bulstrode, these were labours he suffered for his jealous love. No one must replace him. No one else get a chance to play Miranda's lover. Now her voice came, asking his whereabouts. From within the crumbling security of his cave, he called to her,
"Is it your voice, my love, or do I dream?"
On learning that it was indeed her voice, he was obliged to come scrambling out. She was wearing a peach-coloured camlet gown this afternoon, opening over a stiffened petticoat of the same colour. A lace fichu covered her shoulders, but allowed the skin to glow through. Her hair was drawn back softly over her ears and tied in a knot behind.
"Oh, heavenly creature! 10 times more gentle than your father's cruel!"
He had now somehow to cover the space between them, take her hand and gaze into her eyes.
"While I stand gazing thus, and thus have leave to touch your hand, I do not envy freedom."
It was a scene that left him feeling strangely weak. Of its effect on her he was not sure, but these days he read an expression of trouble in her eyes. There was a momentousness in these exchanges, conducted always before spectators, that was beyond anything in his experience. A curious tension between avowing and dissembling, in which real feelings chased pretended ones, and the studied movements about the stage cast all in doubt, until the naked exchange of looks brought a kind of certainty back. Eyes locked together, hands clasped, and breaths intermingling, Ferdinand and Miranda played their allotted roles, while Erasmus Kemp and Sarah Walpert had thoughts for which they had as yet developed no dialogue. It was a lack that came mainly from want of occasion. So far, he had not succeeded in being completely alone with her for more than a few minutes at a time. By contrast, he had seen more of Charles Walpert in these few weeks than during the previous 10 years. He was not particularly drawn to Charles, but he was her brother, after all. The same parents had engendered them both, the same blood ran in their veins. Something of her might be shed on him, though it seemed unlikely. Charles taking after his father, with the same dark eyes and prominent nose. However, it was the nearest he could get. So he went riding with Charles, accepted a spaniel bitch that he didn't really want from Charles, dined out with Charles and other young men of Charles's acquaintance. On the few occasions when, by accident or contrivance, he had found himself alone with Sarah, he had floundered, rather. The time had been too short. He had failed to find words that, without startling her, would do justice to his feelings. In this she had not given him a great deal of help. That she knew what his feelings were, he had no doubt whatever. It was the nature of hers he was not sure of. Offstage, in her real person, she was considerably less frank about them than Miranda. He garnered what crumbs he could get, smiles or words that were for him alone, glances they had exchanged one evening when he had dined there and she had played on the clavichord and sung for them, while old Walpert sat heavy-lidded and the mother stitched at some eternal embroidery. So far, this had been all. Today, midway through the rehearsal, refreshments were brought down from the house in an operation that involved the ancient footman, Andrew, 2 kitchen maids with trays, and the stable boy with a card table. Tea and wine and sweet cakes were laid out on this. Erasmus was making towards Sarah, who was for the moment alone, when he found Parker in his way. The curate's face had the pale, ardent look it always wore when he was about to offer advice. He was dressed in his best clerical garb today, black silk stockings, a suit of black broadcloth, and an immaculate white neckband. He had come from a baptism. The vicar had been away from the parish for some weeks now, and Parker had much to do.
"I hope you won't be put out by this, Kemp," he said. "But I think, and I'm not alone in this, in fact I have been delegated to speak to you, that you emerge from your cave in too soldierly a style, almost as if you were answering the call of the bugle, rather than the voice of one whom your soul cherishes. Try relaxing the shoulders."
Here, as if in illustration, Parker moved his own narrow shoulders up and down in a series of shrugs.
"I know you'll take this in good part," he said. "To assist me with Caliban, I am constantly practising the sinuous movements of the savage."
Erasmus hated advice of any kind as an unwarranted and impertinent comment on his activities. It was particularly displeasing just at present, as it had cost him his chance of a few moments alone with Sarah, who he saw had now seated herself on a bench and had Trinculo on one side of her and Hippolyto on the other.
"You may be right," he said coldly. "Can I, by the same token, bring to your attention what is generally considered an imperfection in your portrayal of Caliban? I'm referring to that part in the second act when Trinculo plies you with wine and you take him for a god. It is not felt that you are totally convincing as a drunken monster. You do it more as if you were taking the sacrament, if I may say so."
A flush had risen to Parker's face. His excitable hair was glinting round his head like an aureole.
"But you have totally failed to understand that scene," he said. "Caliban's not drunk. He's exalted. He says it himself. It is celestial liquor that he is given to drink. It brings out all the poetry of his nature. His new master offers him freedom and enlargement. A new world is opened up before his eyes. All he has to do is lay down his burden and..."
He was interrupted here by the tutor, Bulstrode, who always assumed he would receive immediate attention.
"What do you think, Parker?"
he said, advancing on them, glass of wine in hand, some remnants of cake in his mouth, still not fully masticated.
"As the speech stands, it's quite out of character for Prospero, at least as I conceive him. As I conceive him, he cannot err. He is infallible. I'm talking about the scene we've just done, where he sends Miranda to talk to Ferdinand. It is a most egregious blunder for Prospero to tell her to speak for Hippolyto, as this only arouses Ferdinand's jealousy and brings about the duel, the very thing that Prospero..."
Erasmus saw Sarah get up from the bench and settle her skirts in a way that suggested she was not going to sit down again. Perhaps he could intercept her somehow, contrive a tête-à-tête, however brief.
"I think we have difficulties enough without starting to rewrite the play," he said to Bulstrode.
She was coming towards them with the apparent intention of joining her brother and Miss Edwards, who were standing together further along the lakeside. He excused himself and moved away, timing the manoeuvre so that he and Sarah came face to face as she was passing between the water and the edge of the trees. Both stopped. There was no one else within the space of several yards. Erasmus was awkwardly silent for some moments. He had not thought of what he would say. Absurdly, he found himself tempted to echo Ferdinand.
"While I stand gazing thus..."
But she did not, as Miranda did, sustain his gaze for long.
"How did our scene go, do you think?" he said. "Any better?"
"Yes, I think it was better this time." Erasmus hesitated. She was looking away from him still. Some grace bade him tell the truth.
"It was no better," he said, "and it was all my fault. I cannot act. I cannot stop thinking of Erasmus Kemp for long enough."
She had smiled at this. "And Mr. Bulstrode, for example, does he not think about himself?"
"Aye, but he thinks of himself and his part together. I cannot think I could have the luck to be Ferdinand."
"Luck?"
"Yes. His Miranda loves him. She returns his love. He can speak to her when there is no one else nearby."
He paused again, confused by the rush of feeling his own words had brought. He said precipitately and almost violently,
"That would be a welcome prison to me, too, in the like case."
He saw her bring a pale hand up to her neck to touch the small locket there, in a gesture that seemed like one of self-protection or alarm, but her eyes rested on him steadily.
"May I come to visit? To the house?" he said,
and felt the blood leave his face with the question. As he whitened, she had blushed. "My brothers," she said, "will always..."
"No,
It is to see you.
She surprised him now with a smile, in which there seemed genuine amusement. To practice our scenes?
If you like.
He had little humour, and certainly saw nothing at all humorous in the present situation. That she could do so, that she could have this difference of sensibility, came as a shadow on his sense of her perfection. Other girls, he had known, took their tone from the man, and he was to remember later how, even at such a moment, the play was uppermost in her mind. There was a firmness of self-possession about her which she felt fully now for the first time. She was fair-skinned, and the motions of her blood betrayed her, but whatever agitation she felt was mastered quickly. Her face, as she regarded him now, had returned to its flawless and delicate composure. Her blue eyes were fixed on him with a candidness he found difficult to match. She was seeing him, he felt suddenly, and something within him quivered at being seen.
"Will you allow me?" he said.
"I shall have to speak to my parents."
There's a quality in this almost childish, as if it concerned permission for some treat. "Yes," he said. "Of course, speak to them."
He found he had some trouble in controlling his breathing. He did not know what her sentiments were. His own agitation obscured what indications she had given him.
"But you,"
he said, and hesitated. And everything waited with him. The sky, the pale gleam of the lake, all the marks of the season around them, the candled domes of the chestnut trees, the meadow-sweet along the edges of the wood, half-choked in the long flowering grass, all the musky secretions of May enfolded his question, endorsed with the promise of summer, her continuing silence, which he read now as consent, or complacence at least. He might have demanded more from her. But at this moment Charles Walpert, who, without his noticing, had moved to a central position among them, began to make a speech. It was some time before Erasmus could collect himself sufficiently to take in the words, though he understood the matter was grave, as all matters touched on by Charles seemed to be. At 21 he had acquired already his father's habit of weighty pauses. This natural solemnity made him effective in the role of Stefano, endowing the drunken mariner with a comic sort of ducal dignity. "There was general dissatisfaction," he was saying now, "at the way these rehearsals were progressing. It was felt, he had felt it himself, that there had been a loss of direction. Apart from anything else, there were too many conflicting opinions, he would not say squabbles, about the way things should be done. He had begun to fear, and he was not alone in this, that at this rate they would never arrive at the point of an actual performance. He felt responsible for the business because it had been his and Sarah's idea in the first place, as an entertainment for their father on his 60th birthday, and they were acting as hosts to the rest. In view of all this, he had taken it upon himself to invite an acquaintance of one of his London cousins to come up and spend a few days as his guest and give the company the benefit of his advice. He trusted this would meet with general assent. It was a bid to save the enterprise, which otherwise was in danger either of breaking down in disorder or petering out altogether. He is a London man," Charles said with utmost gravity. "He comes highly recommended. I understand from my cousin that he is a man of the theatre to his fingertips, a playwright and critic. He is a man fully qualified to oversee our efforts and give us the benefit of his counsel. Naturally, a man of that calibre has demands upon him, but he has made the time for us. He has said that he can come. I expect him within the week." In short, they were to have a director. Chapter 16. When the Liverpool Merchant was 3 days out, and rounding to clear the island of Anglesey, the weather thickened, and squalls began to build up from the southeast. Through the night they grew in strength, and by mid-morning of the next day it was blowing so hard that the trysail and topsails, and later the foresail, had to be handled, and the boats lashed to the scuppers. These were dark hours for Paris. Feeling the disquiet of approaching seasickness, he took some powdered ginger root as a preventative, and afterwards went up for air. But the shriek of the wind and the rigging, the tilting deck, the unaccustomed difficulty of the footing, and the rapid movements of the men as they worked to take in the topsails, bewildered him. Despite the ginger, his anguish grew on him with dire speed. Clutching at the gunwale, he vomited wildly to leeward in the dark, and when the spasm was over, went below. Here, on his narrow bunk, in the close confines of his cabin, he rolled and groaned with a shrieking ship, prey in the darkness to shuddering waves of nausea, the like of which he had never known, and which excluded all other sensations, save a sort of feeble astonishment at his capacity for suffering. Long after all the contents of the stomach had been voided, the miserable body kept up its writhing and retching until the thin, bitter stuff he dribbled out seemed like the curds of his own rotted substance, the very taste of dissolution. Above him, at intervals that seemed as arbitrary as the bouts of sickness or the spurts of dreams that visited him from time to time, he heard the sound of the ship's bells, and there were moments, either in his dream time or the real life of the ship, periods of lull, almost of silence, when he would hear a swift patter of rain on the deck, creaking of blocks, shouted orders, and the hoarse, peculiar singing of the sailors at their ropes. Then all was swallowed in the loud impact of the heavy head sea on the ship's bows, and the rippling detonations of the sails as they filled out and backed. All-pervading, adding inexpressibly to his nausea, was the stench of the bilge water shaken up in the depths of the hold below him, like some excretion of the labouring ship. For a maiden, her breath was atrocious. This purgatory lasted most of the night. On the following morning, weakened but feeling light and purged and ravenously hungry, Paris went up on deck. The weather had cleared. The light seemed strangely pure to him, like the primal light of the world. The sea was still choppy and seamed with white, but the sky looked as soft as some small bird's breast. He saw two men high up on a crosspiece of the mainmast. Others were hauling on a rope immediately below to sway up the yards. Thurso stood on the quarter-deck with the helmsman directly behind him. Paris gave the captain good morning, heard no reply, and went directly to the galley, where he found Morgan the cook, stirring with a long ladle in a deep and narrow-necked iron cauldron. "What is that?" he asked. Morgan removed the short, foul-looking pipe from his mouth.
"Lobscouse, sir, that is what they call it."
Morgan's face had a shine of sweat that seemed permanent. He wore a calico apron, greasy with the wipings of his hands, and a ragged bonnet of dark red wool sat on top of his head. This cap was his badge of office on board. No one ever saw him take it off.
"What is lobscouse?"
"That is according to what goes in it."
There was something sullen in this, and Paris realized after a moment that the man distrusted him, and perhaps thought his question some kind of a trick.
"No," he said. "Really, I do not know. What is in this particular one?"
"Salt beef, potatoes and onions and this."
"Please go on with your smoking. It is not ready now, I suppose."
"No, sir. Only just got the fire up after this dirty weather. It will be given out to the men at dinner time. 8 bells.
Morgan paused. He still had not looked directly at Paris.
"There is burgoo left over from breakfast," he said at last.
"Burgoo?
It is only boiled oatmeal, sir, with a bit of sugar."
"I will have a good bowlful of that," Paris said. "Make it up thick, will you?"
"Very good, sir. I'll get the boy to bring it below."
No, Paris said. "I'm unwilling to wait so long. I will have it here and now."
"Here, sir?"
Scandalized into directness at last, Morgan permitted himself a stare.
"In the galley?"
He saw a smile come slowly to transform the surgeon's white face.
"Yes," Paris said. "And as soon as may be."
From his place by the helm, Thurso had watched the emergence of his surgeon with an ill will tempered only by his weariness. He had slept hardly at all since the onset of the squally weather, undergoing the travails of storm baptism for his ship, a kind of agony commensurate with that endured by Paris, though on the plane of spirit rather than flesh. He had felt the gallantry of the vessel. She would strain and tear her own ligaments if kept too close hauled, but to turn her away from the wind meant detours and delays, and this conflicted savagely with his wish to make good time on the voyage. Standing in the roaring darkness, hands fast to the rail of the quarter-deck, he issued his orders, heard Barton transmit them, heard the human voices blend with the voices of the wind. Rising from brief slumber, he thought he saw the running glimmers of aurora borealis in the northern sky, fugitive traces of crimson and gold, gone as soon as glimpsed. It was earlier in the year than any man had reported seeing the merry dancers in these latitudes, and Thurso knew it for a sign to him, and had the cables clinched round the mainmast, and the t'gallant masts lowered. Sure enough, this morning the wind had abated and veered to the west, and the sea had calmed. The masts and lower yards were swayed up again, and by noon they were making good progress with an easy breeze from westward. But the weather made sport of them still. 2 miles round the head, and just out of the road, a whispering calm descended. The ship loitered, drying her sails in pale sunlight. Then the wind sprang up again, but from the wrong quarter, from the southwest. Darkness fell as they made slow way southwards over a sea split with low ridges to the horizon. Next morning, savagely out of temper at these perversities of the wind, Thurzo was approached by the boatswain with a complaint that one of the men had made to strike him.
"James Wilson, a man's name," Haines said. "Others saw him raise his hand to me. It is not on my report alone."
"No matter if it was."
Thurzo considered the bright, narrow-set eyes and the bitter mouth of the man before him.
"I take your word until I know different," he said.
This was untrue. He trusted no one, and least of all a man who offered to call witnesses before he was doubted. There were the lineaments of cruelty in the boatswain's face. Thurzo had seen them too often before in men of every type and cast of feature to be mistaken now. This was not necessarily a bad thing. If the men feared the boatswain, they were likely to put more into the work, and they were at the beginning of a long voyage. The authority of the ship's officers must be upheld. Thurzo despised cruelty, as he did compassion and all other redundant shoots of the human spirit. He knew he was not himself cruel, but merely practical and obedient to the counsels of necessity. They came to him now. Reduce the man. Slight his grievance. Above all, do not seem to share it. He took 2 paces forward to the quarter-deck rail, presenting Haines with his back. From here he looked down over the deck below for some moments in silence. The half-witted landsman that Barton had netted sat cross-legged amidships, surrounded by piles of junk rope, drawing out yarns and knotting them together. His mouth hung open with the effort of concentration. Useless aloft, but Simmons had said that hauling on a rope he was worth 2. Beyond him, well forward, people were getting up tackle to brace the foremast stays. Some of the standing rigging had slackened under the assaults of the gale. He made out the hulking Libby with his black patch, the starveling boy and the little Tynesider. This last was a handy one, he noted with sombre approval. He was shaping to the work well. There was blood down the front of his nankeen jacket.
"What's his name again, the little one there?"
he said, keeping his back still turned to the boatswain.
"Him taking up the slack, cocky little devil."
"I asked you for his name, not his character."
"His name is William Blair, sir." "And that milk-faced fellow beside him? The tall one who always seems to be looking through the air for something?" "That's Michael Sullivan, sir, the fiddler."
"Aye, we shall find a good use for his fiddle when we have the negroes on board. His clothes are falling off him. I cannot have a man walking about my ship in rags. I warrant he's verminous, too. We'll have vermin aplenty before we are done. We can try for a clean start, at least."
"Yes, sir."
"He's not alone. I've seen others in the same case. That filthy little Scotchman. McGann, sir. When time affords, I want those men taken to the heads, stripped off and sluiced well down, and their clothes burned. They can be given slop clothes from the stores, and I want it charged against their pay. Aye, aye, sir. Come forward to me here,"
Thurzo said, turning slightly round.
"Now regarding this Wilson, he's an able seaman, if I mistake not, before the mast man?"
"Yes, sir."
"What took place?" "It was early today. The wind was just coming round fair, and we were swaying up the gallants. We had to look alive, every man of us, to get the benefit. Then was your order, sir. It seemed to me that the men were not putting their backs into it, so I started him up a bit in a normal way, and he turned sharp round at me."
"You saying you gave him a stroke of the rattan to smarten them up?"
"Yes, that's right, sir." "One stroke, or more than one?"
"One here, one there."
Thurzo observed with rising malignity that the fellow was permitting himself a slight smile.
"And the same to each man?"
"I don't well remember, sir."
Thurzo looked closely into the boatswain's face. The dark eyes were unabashed, alight with an energy of their own.
"You don't remember," he said. "Can you not count? You'd better learn. He saw it was you, and he raised his hand?"
"Aye,"
the boatswain said with a sort of bitter pride.
"He knew it was me right enough."
Thurzo considered for some moments longer. The man Wilson would have to be punished, so much was certain. A day in irons would meet the case, but was it enough? He thought again of the sign he had been given in the night, in the worst of the gale, those glimmers of crimson among the scudding clouds. And now these contrary winds and calms, 8 days out, and they were not yet clear of the Dungarvan Highland. A square-rigged ship in narrow waters. With unlucky weather, they could be caught in this channel as long again, or longer. Something was clogging, preventing.
"Have a man brought up on deck and put in irons," he said. "I will make an example of him."
"Aye, aye, sir. Thank you, sir."
"Damn you, I don't want your thanks."
Thurzo turned his eyes on the boatswain and saw the man's head react slightly and the dark eyes open wide.
"Artemy Haines," he said. "Do not try to come too near me, or you will get scorched. You take that tack, and you will find your mistake soon enough, and you'd better learn to count. Driving the men is one thing, but I don't want bad blood on the ship more than I can help. Now get off my deck, and go about your work."
Billy Blair, hauling on the larboard tackle to set up the stays, saw the raw-boned Yorkshireman Wilson brought up on deck, and the heavy leg-irons fastened on him.
"Christ save us," he said. "We're not out of Georgie's channel yet, and they're starting already. What has the poor lad done?"
Solomon's dazed and beautiful eyes regarded him through the mesh of the ratlines.
"What has he done?" he said. "He has committed the wrongdoing of being aboard of this ship."
"You daft twist," Billy said irritably. "How could he have known it when he stepped aboard?"
"Anyone who knows anything about the law knows that ignorance is no excuse. We got a flogger for a bo'sun, and a hound for a mate, and a divil for a skipper, and a year of hell to look forward to, and you ask me what the lad has done?"
"Your argument doesn't hold water,"
Billy said, after some moments of reflection.
"They cannot put a lad in irons only for existing."
"Can they not?" Sullivan said. "Holy Mary, I wish it was dinner time. Me hands has all come to pieces with these ropes, being out of the way of it these days. Well, it is my own fault, sure enough. I should have minded my own business. I should never have taken your part."
"I wish you'd give over on that tack," Billy said.
Libby was passing by them, his arms full of chafing gear.
"I heard you're going to get a nice new suit of clothes," he said to Sullivan,
and gave a yellow-toothed grin that was too prolonged for friendliness.
"I don't know what you're talking about," Sullivan said.
"Shag off, blob, eh?"
Billy said pugnaciously. Neither of them trusted Libby, who was rumoured to be on close terms with Haines.
"Prick ears!"
Libby was searching for further insults when the second mate came up to them.
"I don't want to hear so much talking," Simmons said. "You, Libby, get after that gear. There's a man in irons already. Do you want to keep him company?"
"Thank you for sending that man about his business, Mr. Mate. He was hanging about and impeding our work,"
Sullivan said, displaying a smile of gap-toothed charm.
"That's enough. Get on there."
8 bells were sounded shortly afterwards, but before anyone could move to go below, there came the boatswain's whistle and his long-drawn cry summoning all hands on deck. The men of Barton's watch came tumbling up. Barton himself took up a position on the quarter-deck, a pace or two behind Thurzo. Simmons remained with the men on the deck below. Haines tilted his head to give his lungs free play.
"All hands to witness banishment!"
he shouted at the top of his voice, as if to include the sky itself and whatever beings might be dwelling there. The crew lined up against the rails to starboard or port, according to watch. Thurzo turned to Barton.
"Everybody present?"
"The doctor is not here yet, sir."
The captain's heavy jawbones became more prominent, and he paused for a moment before speaking.
"Haines, I want Mr. Parris up here as soon as may be."
In the interval, no word was spoken, no sound came from those waiting in line at the rails, or from the sullen man in his fetters, seated between them, who kept his head down, looking at no one. The wind had dropped again to a faint breath from the west. There was not sea enough to slap the ship's bows. She dallied there, sails set to the topgallants, and scarce enough breeze to give her steerage way. Parris emerged to this silence, climbed the companion ladder to the quarter-deck, and took up a position alongside Barton. He knew what was going to happen without needing to be told, some blend of experience and instinctive knowledge informing him that this silent assembly was there to do or witness hurt to a fellow being.
"Glad you were able to get here, Mr. Parris,"
Thurzo said with malignant sarcasm.
"Strike off the man's irons and rig the grating," he said to Barton.
The fetters were taken off by Haines, with Libby assisting. Wilson got stiffly to his feet. Hughes and the cooper, a man named Davis, dragged aft one of the wooden gratings used to cover the hatches. This was laid upright and secured to the bulwarks by the lee gangway.
"Grating rig, sir," Davis said.
"Mr. Barton, ask the man if he's anything to say."
But Wilson had heard this. Before the mate was finished speaking to him, he raised his head and looked up steadily at the figure on the quarter-deck. He was a big-boned, powerful man with a gaunt face and pale, washed-out eyes.
"Nought that can help," he said.
"Aye," Thurza said grimly. "Your help comes when I stay my hand. Seize him up."
Haines and Libby were holding him still, but lightly. They would have stripped off his shirt, but he drew back sharply, pulled it over his head, and dropped it from him. Then he walked alone to the foot of the gangway and raised his arms, so his wrists could be lashed to the grating. He was deeply tanned at the neck and arms, but his back was pale, and the scars of old floggings were visible on it.
"Seized up, sir,"
Haines reported. Deacon, standing to starboard with the others of his watch, witnessed these preliminaries with a familiar sickness, compounded of his own old fear and pain. He knew that pride of refusing to be manhandled to the grating, doomed pride, because the flogging always brought a man to his knees. Deacon had been beaten, and seen men beaten for almost as long as he could remember, and he knew that the Yorkshireman would be given extra for raising his head and looking steady, not for spite, but because flogging was meant to reduce a man. On a slave ship, it would not be the boatswain that would deliver the lashes, or either of the mates. The grievance would be too strong for this looser discipline. Officers and men had often to work side by side, with their hands dipping in the same grease tub. Things could happen that looked like accidents. Or a knife between the ribs and over the side, and nobody the wiser. No, it would be the skipper. He was talking now, in his hoarse, unchanging voice. Deacon took in the sense without paying much attention to the particular words. He had heard similar speeches on a dozen ships. Wilson had raised his hand against one of the appointed officers. This was to raise his hand against the captain himself. He, Thurso, was not the man to stand this. They did not know him yet. They would get to know him, by God. He could be a devil incarnate to them if they crossed him. If they went his way, he could be sweet as honey. Let everyone see and take note what would befall them at any failure of duty or breach of discipline. Thurso divested himself of his coat and waistcoat, handing them to Barton, who came forward for them like a valet. Haines was undoing the red baize bag in which the cat was kept. To Paris, already bracing himself for what was to come, there was a horrifying elegance in this ritual disrobing, despite the incongruities of the captain's thick figure and his big, square, weather-beaten face. He might have been in his changing-room at a levee, his attendants about him, his petitioners below. He took the whip from Haines and stepped down the companion. He measured his distance, took two short steps, and struck with full power of his arm. They heard the swish of the tails and the pattering crack of the impact. A loud, deep panting sound came from Wilson as the breath was driven from his body by the force of the blow. Paris saw the tendons of the man's neck tighten with his effort to make no sound. The first blow had opened his back, and a broken line of blood showed where the knots had cut. Thurso delivered stroke after stroke with unfaltering ferocity and astounding energy, his eyes staring and his face dark red and swollen-looking. Wilson still made no sound, but he writhed against the grating. His back was a red slough from neck to waist. Drops of blood were scattered over the deck with each stroke. At the tenth, and each one thereafter, Thurso was obliged to pause in order to run his fingers through the tails of the cat to free them from blood and bits of flesh. The 14th blow broke Wilson's resolve. His knees gave, and he hung by his wrists.
"Oh, God!" he shouted thickly. "God, help me!"
"Aye,"
Thurso said, shaking drops over the deck. He had stains of blood on the sleeve and shoulder of his shirt. There were beads of sweat on his face, and his chest was rising and falling heavily.
"You're singing now, are you? You'd better call on Thurso. He's nearer."
It was what he'd been waiting for. Wilson was a hardy ruffian, but he had known he must give way. He took the count to 18, however, before throwing the whip to the boatswain.
"Clear the thongs well for the next man that forgets himself,"
he said, and stumped back up the companion.
Cut the man down, Mr. Barton. Send the crew about their duties. Tell Morgan I want hot water brought to my cabin on the instant.
Freed from the grating, Wilson collapsed at once upon the deck, his eyes fixed and his face darkly congested. Paris saw him half led and half carried below by two men. He stood for some moments struggling to master his disgust and indignation. It came to him that he could assert his will against this brute in a way that poor Wilson, with no privileged exemptions, had not been able to, and so give some dignity to those lacerations. He stepped forward to face the captain.
"Excuse me, Captain Thurso," he said. "I should like the favour of a word with you."
He met the captain's eyes and saw something vacant in them for the moment, the sort of vacancy that sometimes comes after strong effort or emotion.
"It is not convenient at present," Thurso said.
"Sir, this is the third time of asking, and I have a right to be heard."
"A right?" Thurso said. "What do you mean?"
His tone had quickened.
"Do you talk to me about rights here on my deck?"
Paris felt a violent contempt rise in him as he met the renewed glare in the other's eyes. So strong was the feeling that he had consciously to caution himself, discipline himself physically. He clasped his hands together behind his back.
"Yes, sir, I do," he said.
He rested his eyes steadily on Thurso and saw something change in the other's expression as the antagonism was registered.
"I am referring to the question of the sick bay. It has not been cleared yet, in spite of my former request to you. Now there is a clear case of need for it."
"Sick bay?"
Thurso glared up at his listless topsails for a moment.
"Are you mad, Mr. Paris? What need is there now for it, when we have no sickness aboard?"
"I intend to treat that man's back," Paris said. "His lacerations could easily become putrid if not attended to."
"Wilson! God damn my blood!" Thurso said violently. "I don't know whether to laugh or cry at you. I've seen 100 like him treated well enough with a handful of salt."
Paris hesitated. He had not wanted to use his uncle's name, but he was set on winning the day, and not for his own sake only. He said,
"You compel me to remind you that Mr. Kemp intended me to have the use of that room. He so stated, and in your hearing."
He saw that Thurso had clenched his right fist so that the knuckles whitened. At the sight, with a reciprocal impulse of violence he did not know he possessed, and which he was afterwards to think of as some infection of madness, he advanced his face and brought his hands to his sides.
"I want that sick bay cleared, sir, if you please," he said. "Yes, I thought we should hear of your uncle before long."
Thurso seemed about to say more, but suddenly his expression changed, and he lifted his head.
"There! Can you hear it?"
he said.
"Hear what?" "The wind, you fool!"
Listening now more intently, Paris heard a tune in the rigging that he did not think had been there before, and a moment later he felt a breeze against his face. There was a series of rippling sounds as the canvas began to fill out.
"You can have your precious sick bay if it matters so much,"
Thurso said with contempt. He felt the wind increasing, felt the responsive gathering of the ship. It came again, stronger, singing through the ropes, a harmony of high-pitched tones transmitted to the chains and thence through all the timbers, and it was coming from the west.
"You see, it is answered," he said, turning away. "We have freed the wind."
"What do you mean?"
No answer came to this. The captain's face had relaxed into lines of fatigue. He was looking down to the foot of the gangway, where drops of Wilson's blood still glistened. Chapter 17. Erasmus waited for an occasion when his father was in relaxed mood, occasions rarer these days than he had ever known them to be. He chose one evening after supper when his father, at ease in skull-cap and dressing-gown, was smoking a pipe or two in the small oak-panelled sanctum he called his study.
"Can you spare me some minutes, sir?"
Kemp, observing for a while in silence the military posture that his son had adopted, head up and shoulders braced back, was brought to mind of other occasions, going back to earliest childhood, when Erasmus had stood before him thus. Unexpectedly, and in the midst of his anxieties, he found himself visited by compassion for this self-willed son of his, for whom life had always been a succession of self-imposed tests and ordeals.
Just in this way, he thought, Erasmus will bear himself at the news of my ruin, if it comes.
Yes, of course, my boy, he said. What is it?
I want to ask Sarah Walper to marry me, Erasmus said, looking straight before him. That is, I want to ask her father. He stumbled a moment. I want to ask for her hand. I wish to know if you had any objections to such a course, sir.
Walpert's daughter?
Kemp was